All of this is wasted if we can't show impact or have an impact on others. All of us have a story to tell. It's about the man. It's about mentorship.
Check out our website for more exclusive content on www.masterstartup.co.za.
It's about entrepreneurs coming together to say, I have a journey of my own. That journey is not perfect, but I want to see if there's things that I've learned that I can impart on others.
Welcome to the Mass Startup Podcast. I'm Mashim Badal. This podcast is an empowerment platform for the opportunity seekers, the problem solvers, the game changers, the future shapers, the world builders, the entrepreneurs. This podcast will look to explore the very nature of entrepreneurship in Africa and profile entrepreneurs who are breaking new ground in their respective industries.
Okay. After much technical difficulty, we're actually going to get started now.
Okay.
So please introduce yourself.
Hi guys, thanks for having me here. My name is Zanele Madume. I'm the CEO and founder of Nanny Now and on-demand nanny service hire.
Do you want to just go through sort of your journey of entrepreneurship? Like, when did you start wanting to build things that mattered and have a startup? When did you even know what an entrepreneur was?
I started my journey at the age of 21, I think formally. Informally, I started at the age of 16.
What were you doing?
I was a Shebeen queen. I was selling alcohol from my mom's house. Things were tough there, and I was like, you know what? I have to do something. So the lady next door to me was selling beers, and I could see that this is a booming business. So, because I was selling body keep and things like that, and really it was not cutting it.
Yeah.
So I started selling alcohol. We used
Is this the first time you learned about product market?
Yeah, exactly. Now there's a word for it. Yeah, so that's when I started informally and started poaching her clients and started selling beers. Then my sister, who was studying at, what was it called, University of Westville at the time, she got a job and bought some sofas, some couches.
Okay.
And then she closed my business because my customers were using the sofas too much. But then, yeah, that's when my informal Shebeen Queen business closed down. Then I went to varsity.
Okay.
Yeah, I went to varsity. Then on my second year of varsity, it was really boring. I was at RAU at that time.
Now, what were you studying?
I was studying BA Communications.
Oh, cool.
Yes, yes. I wanted to do economics, but because of my maths was really, 30%-ish. Then I just said, okay, let me do BA Communications.
Yeah.
But through my second year of studies, I started getting bored because I could see that I was spending most of my time either in NASREC attending mining conferences or in Santin gate-crashing business breakfasts, business dinners, and just doing all business-related things. Then I went home back to Rustenburg. I sat with my mom, and I said, Mom, I want to drop out. So let's make a deal. I want to drop out now. I want to go into mining or construction. If it doesn't pan out in 3 years, I'll go back to school.
Yeah.
Then she agreed, and then the rest is history. Then I packed my bags, left Joburg, went back home to Rustenburg, started my first construction company at the age of 21.
So you just started the company. You didn't, like, go and study and
no,
go through that process?
No, I didn't study.
Okay, where's this, like, confidence coming from as well? Where's the confidence coming from to do
the
this?
Confidence, I think from attending these conferences, and I could see that I can do better than these guys.
So what did the company do right at the beginning?
We started with subcontracting because at that time I didn't have a car. All I had was my wheelbarrows, and my mom was my family and friend founder, my funder. Yeah, so she was a teacher by then. So I started knocking on companies like your Green Acre, your Group Fives, because it's easy to get a subcontract. It was easy at that time. And my first job was we were building some townhouses where I was paid 50 cent per mambara stena. Mambara stena is that brick that you can paint over, the cheap ones, and 1 rand 50 cent for the face bricks. So that's what that was my first foray into construction.
But what? Where were you getting the bricks from?
No, the bricks, because you're a subcontractor, you get everything from the main contractor. So all you have to do is to bring your wheelbarrows, bring your hand tools, and your tea.
And transport them.
Yes, yes, and transport them, yeah. But with me, because I didn't have a car, I will tell them that there's a spot. Make sure that you get on a taxi by 7 a.m. You are there, because in construction, we don't do 9 to 5. You start very early in the morning. But as well, it was so challenging because I'm young, I'm 21, and you just get people from the street who say, hey, sister, we can build, only to find out when it's time to invoice, because we used to invoice every fortnight. Wompit, who was the supervisor from Greenacre, that side, will come with a waterpas. A waterpas is a thing that, an instrument that you use to measure whether the wall is straight or skewed. And my wall will be so skewed. And, yo, hey, you will cry, you will just so take a hammer.
Is the wall straight or skewed?
Exactly, exactly. And once he comes with a hammer, you know he's going to break down your 50 cents and your 1 rand 50 cents. And at the end of the day, you have to pay those incompetent people who told you that they could actually build. So that's how I learned. I used to cry in those toilets all the time, until I knew my construction story, until I knew that a good builder has to build at least 400 bricks per day, not 20 bricks, you know, and at the end of the day, you have to invoice and things like that. Then from there, I started now getting some subcontract jobs in the mining companies, because I'm from Rustenburg, so I built up on that experience. Then as I started, and maybe when I was, 23, then I started, you know, doing some more mining jobs. Then I went to Sasol. I went to Sasol here in Rosebank when it was still their head office, to just go and present my company, saying that, you know what, now I'm looking for more challenging jobs. Mm. Now I want to go into Sasol refineries and do construction there and do some work in the refineries, because there were a few black females, if ever, that were doing that at that time. Mm. Then I went to present my story to the Sasol CEO. By then, I managed to get an appointment with the CEO. And after the meeting, he was like, I don't want to give you a job. I don't want to give you a contract, but I love your tenacity and your spirit. So I want you to come and work at Sasol. So I was like, and the salary that time was 15,000 rands. And, you know, from the stress of writing my
second. What year is this?
Hey. Is 2003. Mm. Yes, and I was like, okay, no, I'll take it all. I want a stable salary. I've been struggling for too long with this with this contracting and tender business.
How many years did you do the subcontracting in construction?
In construction, 2 years. Mm. 2 years, yeah. I did
so
it 2 years.
Was the appeal of a stable salary and like a fixed income, yes, just like way too appealing?
It was way too appealing, and I was like, you know what? Let me just pause this thing for a while. Let me do this. Then, and he said, you know what, I'm going to create a position for you, so because I want to give you a whole overview of entrepreneurship and the industry. So for me, it was the appeal of a stable salary and also the learnings that I will get from there with just a matric, because it was not easy to just go into Sasol with a matric. Mm. Then they had some interviews there, you know, to see where I could fit in. And they put me in procurement. That's when now I was like, oh, I'm close to home. I'm close to entrepreneurship again. Mm. So I worked there for 2 years as a junior procurement officer, being on the other side of the fence now, learning about the corporate aspect of it, the fundamentals, the systems, and all of that. But after 2 years, I started, you know, scratching again. It's, yeah. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it will always pull you back, whether you like it or not.
Then, but what are the sort of things that you learned in the mining and construction stuff, mm-hmm, that really helped you in that corporate environment and like mining and procurement stuff?
I think what helped me as well was, you know, to deal with entrepreneurs when you are on the other side. Because that time, I remember, I was at the other side as an entrepreneur. So now when I was in procurement and with that experience, I could empathize more with them. I could help them, because some things you must just help them with, especially putting together the right tender document without giving them confidential info, without, you know, bribery and all sorts of stuff. Just help them get a foot in, because most of them, you just there, you opened your own CC. That time it was CC were popular. You open your own CC, you don't know where to start. You didn't go through any incubators. Incubators are things of now. So most of our black people, and you know, coming from apartheid era and all of that, they were not given those that exposure and resources. So from me as a procurement officer on the other side, I think that's how I was helping mostly our black people in that position that I was with, yeah, with advice and all of that. So
So what was the next step?
Then the next step, I resigned. It was even painful for my family. They were used to the black tax, but I was like, no, I have to resign now.
And what motivated that resignation?
I think also corporate. Corporate was not for me. It just holds you back. You can't be as creative as you want. I remember the last straw was when because I didn't have a car, and I was like, okay, I want a car. I want a Ford Fiesta. I think it was one something, the 100 and something. And I said, okay, I can't just wait for month end. How can I raise this 150? Okay, let me have a SMME conference. Then I started organizing an SMME conference, started organizing...
What was it called?
It was called, Black SMME. I don't know, Black SMME funding or something like that. But there was Black and there was SMME. And I started getting sponsors and organizing everything. Then 2 weeks or just a month before the conference, and I even used my money to book the venue, the hotel. Then 2 weeks or a month before the conference, I spoke with my boss to say, oh, I'm inviting you to a conference. It's a Black SMME word, so just come and support. Yeah, so I've organized this. I've been organizing this for the past 6 months. Yo! And then she was furious, and they say, you even use company email address. I didn't know those things, because I was using my company email address
To organize, yes.
I even used company resources, internet, and all of that. And I was called to a disciplinary hearing. I was given a final warning, but for me, I think that was the last straw that, you know what, the corporate is not for me. I was here to learn and live. It's not for me. I'm too creative. I'm too entrepreneurial. I must just go out there and create and build. That's what I do best. So within the confines of corporate and the rules and regulations...
That's not possible.
That was not possible, yeah. So I think that's what drove me to leave.
And what was your next step after leaving?
Yeah, my next step, because I left without a plan, a friend of mine said, oh, there's a company in Mossel Bay. There's a BEE company in Mossel Bay. They've just been awarded a multi-million rand contract doing scaffolding for Petro SA. So because it's a BEE, it was a BEE concept where they take former employees who were unskilled and gave them shares and say, run with this. It was like 25 million per annum contract. It was a scaffolding contract. So they were looking for business development managers and things like people like that to help them structure everything. So I went there. I worked with them. That one was so exciting because it was like a startup starting everything from scratch. Mm. And yeah, and I had, you know, I had the power to do anything that I could to grow with them, because I was one of the team that was helping them grow. Mm. Then I stayed in Mossel Bay for 2 years. Then after that, I said, okay, now I have to go and start my own thing. Then I went back home again and I said, now I'm going into mining. But, you know, I'm not your Petrus Motsepe's. I don't have, you know, to run a mine, to own a mine, you have to have technical capabilities. You have to have capital. It is very capital intensive. But I say, I'm a person who always say, okay, if I can get through the main door, there must be a back door somewhere. Mm-hmm. Then I started researching it, and I found out that in mining, there's something that's called mine contracting, where before they can extract the ore and take it to the market, you need service providers. There's some who do drilling and blasting. There's some who do, you know, open cast, the secondary support. There's so much that you have to do before the actual extraction of the ore and taking it to market. Mm. Then I started researching. Then I came across secondary support services and drill and blasting. And then I said, okay, and I went back to my modus operandi to say that, okay, if you don't have experience in this, you have to subcontract you know, earn your stripes, then go and do it on your own. Mm. Then I approached one of the biggest companies at that time called Shaft Sinkers. They were the ones that actually sink the shaft for the mines, for your Anglos, you know, all types of mines. You have to sink that, especially when you go underground. Then I approached them. Then they gave me an opportunity. Mm. And they say, okay, we'll give you an opportunity. At that time, I was still using taxis. You know, I will come to Noord with my techies. Go, the offices were in Sandton. When you get there, you know, you must always be nice to security guys, please. That's where I used to change into my nice suit and my nice shoes, do my makeup, get in, go back, use that changing room again, go back to my taxis. Then, yeah, they gave me that opportunity. I'm very thankful for Shaft Sinkers.
What do you think it is about sort of your energy or who you are that makes people want to open doors for you?
I think
it seems like there's a trend throughout yes. your career, right, where people are going, this is someone that clearly has something that, you know, they've got something here.
Mm.
And they're willing to open the door, create the opportunity, whether it's developing a whole new role or a situation where they're just giving you an opportunity or, you know, whatever it is. What do you think it is that you have that makes people do that?
I think my energy and my can-do attitude. I don't let, you know, my lack of skills or lack of engineering skills, because I was in a highly engineering system with my 30% maths. So for me, it's my energy and my can-do attitude. And I'm a quick learner, I'm a fast learner, and I'm very passionate. So if I really want something, I'll go after it and I'll make sure that I get the gist of it. So I think that's how it happened. Even with Shaft Sinkers, and they say, no, we'll give you an opportunity. Can you go anywhere in South Africa? Because as well, you know, I can go anywhere in the world. I don't choose places or things like that. Wherever you throw me in Papua New Guinea, in DRC, and I've stayed a month in DRC, by the way. Throw me anywhere, I'll succeed, because I think that's my energy.
Mm.
Yeah, so they gave me that opportunity, and I worked in Orkney. And I found myself a back room there, and I got a team of 14 people, and I'm very claustrophobic. And it was my first time going underground, because I had to go underground and learn the skill before I can even teach my people or teach my future employees. And they gave me my first bikey, which was quite a relief. So yeah, I worked there, went underground. I would sometimes go with the day shift team or the night shift team, where we did secondary support. Secondary support is after they do the drill and blasting, after the development team of the mine, they do the drill and blasting. So the rock is very shaky. So that's when we come with our equipment and our chemicals, and we spray some chemicals on the wall to make the walls, you know, thicker and safe for the mine employees. So you'll spray like your 90mm application, 50mm application, according to what the rock engineer tells you. So that's what I was doing as a young black female.
Yeah. How do you skip from all these very traditional sort of industries? So construction, mining, petroleum, and then to now where you're very invested or focused on tech startups. What is the jump happened?
Yes, I think the tech startup now is my last foray. Now, I'm home. You won't see me baking things and or opening a bakery. Or I think this one, you know, the concept of fight or flight. 2 years ago, was it 2016? Now we're on 2017, somewhere there. I had a nice, cushy contract at Rustenburg Mine, staying in Bryanston, you know, Butler and all, you know, just living the tender life and enjoying myself. And then the rug was pulled under my feet. It was a 5-year contract, and I knew that within that 5 year, I would have finished paying my house, paying this and all of that, and live happily ever after in the tender world. And the mine where I was working, it got closed down. The owners were Canadian, and they pulled out. And, you know, all of us, all contractors and employees, we just had to leave within 3 to 6 months. So I think that was when it hit me that, okay, now it's fight or flight. I had to move out of my home. I had to move back to my mom's house with three kids. I had to let go of my Mercedes. I had to drive my small Scorocoro Corsa. I just had to downgrade my whole life, and it really affected my kids as well. Because it's all nice and good when you are all alone and you're single. But once now you start having kids and you start having responsibilities, those are the things that I usually tell potential entrepreneurs or people who just want to join entrepreneurship, that it's not all hunky-dory. Those are the pitfalls that you must, you must think about, that it happens, and that's the road of an entrepreneur. So I think that one was my wake-up call. So for me, it was fight or flight. And I sat down with myself. I had my own strategic session. I said, you know what? You've been doing this since the age of 21. There's a contract, there's a lull, there's a contract, there's a lull, and things like that. So now you're almost 40. And this cannot be the life for you and your kids. You have so many ideas. You have so many ideas that you've been putting in the back burner because you were very comfortable with the life of tenders and contracts. So now it's time to go for that. Now it's time to dust off those ideas and just go for it. It's now or never. So for me, it was my fight or flight moment. At that time, I used to cry a lot. It was very depressed. I usually say that, entrepreneurs, we go through a lot of stages of undiagnosed depression. So for me, that was it, because my mom will check up on me all the time. And even now that things are good, she will say, hey, the reason I was checking up on you in that bedroom all the time, I really thought you were going to kill yourself because you were really depressed and down and out. I had to wake you up in the morning and say, just go to town, just go to Wimpy, unta stress. So I think that's what we go through. But for me, I was like, okay, now I'm going to fight. I'm a fighter. I have brains. Tenders didn't make me. Tenders are not going to break me. But let me start using my ideas. Then that's when I started really researching the tech space. I was so anti-tech. I actually joined WhatsApp 2 years ago. Never mind Twitter, because I used to SMS and my friends would say, hey, when I'm a go, I don't want your things. So Twitter, as I joined it in 2017, I was not active on Twitter. I started being active on Twitter in June last year after my mentors from Silicon Valley said, no, you must be on Twitter because you love writing and you love engaging.
Yeah.
So you must get with the times.
What? Something that I noticed, that you, every time you want to start something or go into something, you're either attending events about that thing or you reading up about it or researching about it. How important is that part for you when you go into something new?
I think for me, research is very important. Obviously, research won't give you all the answers. There's still an element of risk involved. But at least if you research, you're 60% there. Then the other 40 will be with gut and, played by ear. So for me, research or attending events or reading about something is very important. So that's when I started researching the tech industry. And I knew that, there's something called Silicon Cape. There's Silicon Valley. There's this. So I'm still a newbie here because I really started going deep into it from last year. Then I started looking at the incubators, and I applied for an incubator called Draper University. I think for me, I'm an all or nothing kind of girl. So I said, okay, I'm skipping Silicon Cape. I want to go to Silicon Valley. I was like, okay, the clock is ticking. I just want to go to Silicon Valley. It's make or break.
Yeah.
So, it was another culture shock for my poor family. And my mom was like, I don't understand this tech thing, but I'll support you, my child. At least you live in the bedroom now. At least now you go into the internet cafe. You have a spring in your step. So, I think they were happy about that. Then I applied for Draper. I got through Draper University, the incubator program, but now I got stuck in the middle because they wanted $10,000 USD to pay for the incubator. It's not like your YC where you can get for free and things like that.
Yep.
They wanted $10,000 USD. I thought I could raise it. I couldn't, but I couldn't raise it. Then I got an accident with my Corsa. I got into an accident with my Corsa, and because it has, I have driven it like for 400,000 Ks, the insurance company paid about, what, 30 to 35. And as I was like, you know what, I'm not even going to deposit another car. What, I'm going to use this money to go to Silicon Valley. I'll buy a return ticket via Emirates, even though it takes forever. It's 18K. And I said, the rest, I'll sleep in hostels or things like that. I'm going, I'll create my own incubator program. Because I knew that there are office hours there, which was something very interesting for me, where you could meet with people like Jason Calacanis or what, for free. They, you know, they sit you guys. It's called office hours. And they'll give you advice. You'll ask questions. It's intimate. You'll meet with people who've worked in Amazon, in fintech. You know, you will meet with experts and authorities of industry. And I said, you know what? That can be my incubator program. This is what I'm going to do. And I'll also attend a lot of these events, which goes for like $20, $40, your brunch works. There's another one called Lunch Club, where you schedule a lunch with your fellow founders, investors, people in the industry, go for coffee. You have 1 hour, you chat. So I said, no, I'll use this as my incubator. So that's when I packed up my things and went to Silicon Valley. That was
that's insane. Where, again, where does the confidence come from?
I know. Yeah, then, I think it goes with some, yeah, maybe craziness, I don't know. Yeah, so that's when I left.
So what was your experience of sort of Silicon Valley's entrepreneurship and startup culture? I guess it's not fair to say, you know, you must compare it, but like, what was your experience of Silicon Valley?
Wow, man, the startup culture there, it's insane. And it's like everybody wants you to win. It's a culture where everybody helps you out. Everybody wants you to win. And everybody's free with information. So information is freely available. So for me, that was it. That's what, and I told myself that, you know what, Zanele, you made a good decision. This was a really good decision. You didn't waste anything by using your last money to do this. So for me, there was this, and information. For me, information is power. So that's what I got there. A lot of info, a lot of people want to help, a lot of people giving their time and resources to help you to get to the next level. People who don't even know you. So yes, there is that snack of having warm intros if you want to, you know, meet like high ups, VCs and all of that. But people who, most of the people, really it's easy to interact and meet with them and get information from them.
What would you say is different about sort of our ecosystem, whether it's South Africa or just the continent in general?
I think here, before I meet you, Mashudu, I'm just going to have to go through the bulldog of your PA, who will give me 3 months before I even get a meeting, especially once you reach the billion dollar level or whatever, you know, once you are at the echelons of power. So I think here, our people who've made it are not accessible. They are not accessible to us who are starting out. We're not saying give us money. We don't want money. For me, I never want money. I want information. I want strategic help. I want, you know, don't hold my hand. Don't even hold my hand. Just give me information that to get A to B, here's an, do this, don't do that, because I've been through that. That will burn you quickly. We just want that 30 minutes, 15 minutes interaction of information. That's it. So that we can also grow. Because you must, I always believe that you must raise as you rise. So here at home, we don't raise as we rise. You're going to raise only the people that you know and the people who know you. Otherwise, it's me, myself, and I. So I think for me, that was the main difference. That's the main gripe that I have. Other than that, you know, once you have information, you will get the money. You will make some means.
Yeah.
But but let's just share the ecosystem. Let's just share. Let's just raise each other up. The cake is so big, really, for everyone to share. So, yeah.
Yeah. Earlier on, I think we were just chatting. I want to introduce Ubuwele, who's going to be co-hosting some of my podcasts with me this year.
Great
He's
stuff.
My new business partner as well.
Great stuff.
He wears glasses. He's a very nice guy.
They suit him.
I'm a typical black man. I'm bald and I want a beard.
So, I mean, earlier we were just chatting about sort of the funding landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of, what was the fund we were chatting about?
I think it's Kingston Capital, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, just how much money they had.
Mm.
What are the sort of things you've seen in terms of, you know, VC funding or just in general, what entrepreneurs should be looking at to raise money? Obviously, it starts with the friends, you know, friends, fools, and what?
Family.
Friends, family, and fools.
And fools.
Yes.
I need that last F.
Which
my fools? Friends are not doing enough. My family isn't doing enough. I need the fools. I need the fools. Only the fools can make this work.
Can we add the Forex guys as well?
Exactly.
They can help us. It's another F.
That's the fourth one. That's the fourth F now. Friends,
family,
fools, and Forex guys. But what do you think people should be looking at in terms of where they want to find funding? Mm-hmm. And also, what's been your experience of raising funding and sort of building out what you're building now?
Mm. I think with funding, it's very difficult if you just have an idea, because you know, you have an idea and you try to sell it to somebody that you don't even have a relationship with. So I think with funding, the best place to start is just start. Even if you start with your 10 clients, your 50 clients, just start and gain some momentum, because the start will help you with gaining product market fit, number one. It will help you believe in the product and sell it much easier, because you'll be doing 90% of your time, you'll be doing selling. You'll be selling. No, before that, yes. So I think just that the art of it is to just start. Start, then you start now convincing your angels. And I think before you even go to your VCs, because now we're talking, you know, your seed or pre-seed. Now I've heard of soil seed. Yeah.
Soil seed.
Yes.
What's soil seed?
That's the first time I'm hearing that.
You should check it out. We were chatting about it with some angels on Twitter. That, things. Hey, yeah. So soil seed, I guess maybe it's your $10,000, $5,000. Excuse me, guys. Now we are getting dollar language.
How about we try this, right? So soil seed being $5,000 to $10,000.
Yes.
What would seed be exactly?
Seed has really changed, because before seed could be between $50,000 and $250,000. Mm-hmm. But with my experience in Silicon Valley in San Francisco, some seed can go up to your $2 million. So I think it's up to your product. But the seed landscape is really changing. Even now, you can find people who are getting seed for $2 million, like my competitor. For the company I wanted to first launch at San Francisco, Esusu, because I had a product like your stock, digitalizing stock files, but the product market fit was not there, so I had to pivot very quickly. But my competitor there just raised a seed of $1.6 million, which was last year, August. So the seed landscape is changing. But for maximum now, it's plus minus $2 million. But you can even start from 50K.
Yeah. Mm. You talked about starting with what you have, right?
Mm.
Like if I was somebody in South Africa starting a tech company,
mm-hmm.
like what would the first thing that I should do? Would it be maybe... like, I'm not a technical founder. Like, will the first thing be finding a developer to do that? Will the first thing be, I don't know, writing out the idea or just trying building it out myself and then find somebody else with those technical skills? Or, you know, what would you say the first thing should be if you're building a tech company in South Africa?
If you like, thanks for that question. If you're like me, because I'm a non-technical founder, I knew nothing about tech. So for somebody like me who's non-technical, but you have the idea, you start jotting down your idea and find a technical co-founder. But a technical co-founder is like getting into a marriage. You don't just pick somebody else, because you might end up fighting, you know, and things like that. So if you don't have somebody in mind who can be a technical co-founder, who's very good with the tech aspect of it, who can easily build the MVP, rather than outsource to a developer and let them build an MVP for you, then you can start. Then that part will come. But as you scale, I think really for peace of mind, because tech is not like now the traditional businesses that you can do solo forever. But as you scale, the best thing is to get a technical co-founder. But if you don't have anybody in mind or anybody in your circle for now, get a developer, pay for them to do the MVP, then start. Then as you build your network, really get a technical co-founder to just there. Yeah.
Like let's say I didn't have money at all.
Okay, right? Yes.
So I did not know anybody who had the type of skills that I needed, like to be a technical co-founder. Mm. But there was somebody in mind, or like a development hub, or with a couple of software guys who can actually build the MVP for me. What payment options do I have?
But you don't have the money.
Yep. Do I give them a piece of the business, or do you know?
Yeah, give them sweat equity. I think that's the best. If you don't have the money, just give them sweat equity. Because 100% of nothing is nothing. So give them equity, then they can come on board to come and build your MVP or build your product with you.
Don't you always think the obsession with 100% ownership and this is mine, it's such an obsessive but like ignorant thing, because you can keep 100%. And just never raise money and never be able to do anything. But do you have that same attachment to your business or your idea? Or is it something that you grow out of as well?
I used to have that same attachment that, you know, it's 100% mine, because growing up in traditional businesses, being exposed to traditional businesses and watching your maponyas and all of them. You know, but as you grow and as you evolve in business, and especially in tech, 100%, is really nothing. You look at your Jeff Bezos, your Mark Zuckerbergs, you know, your Elons. 100% won't take you anywhere. Bring in people, give them equity, scale, and build your business. I used to be like that. So yeah, I know it's a problem with most entrepreneurs, especially coming from traditional business backgrounds. But it doesn't work. It's not sustainable. It won't take you anywhere, and it won't make you grow. So yeah, it doesn't work.
Like we talked earlier on about after the 3Fs, moving on to like the angels of the world who give you like good money to build out your business. What do you think in South Africa is a problem with our angel network in terms of funding? Because we do have people with money in South Africa. Is it because they're inaccessible, like you talked about it, or there's no like a collective effort to bring them together to invest in tech companies?
I think the first thing is that they're inaccessible. Number two is that most of them, not all, but most of them are very much risk averse. So they want you to come with your 3-year financials. They want you, ready to rock and roll. So most of them are risk averse. If you can just have a vibrant ecosystem of angel investors who speak the language of seed, pre-seed. Okay, we can...
Soil seed.
soil seed.
Don't forget soil seed. Very important.
So you talked about skipping Silicon Cape and going straight to Silicon Valley, right? But there's been a concisive effort by Silicon Cape to sort of institutionalize the network of VCs that we have in South Africa. And there's been growing funds in South Africa that are working together with incubators to have a collective effort to invest in technology companies. Do you think those people need to sort of educate the other high net worth individuals in South Africa to say, no, try not be risk averse, try, bet on something else, because in South Africa, we currently live in a zero growth rate economy, and we're having tech companies like skyrocketing. So how do you think the current institutionalized VCs like Silicon Cape could educate the potential angel network we have in South Africa?
I think there could be a meeting of minds between the two, because you're right, we do have your Silicon Cape, we do have your VCs, and we do have a lot of high net worth individuals sitting on a lot of money that could be doing a whole lot of good for them and also for entrepreneurs, because this is not charity. So yeah. For them, just imagine the people who invested in Uber or now in Plaid when it was still pre-seed and seed. So I think, like you said, there should be a communication and, like, I don't know, some teaching of some sort, some opening, some mind shift. I think, the concept is mind shift. Yeah. There should be a mind shift between the two. The two should marry, and there should be a mind shift to tell them that here's the bottom line. If you invest in these companies, here's what it's going to do to your bottom line. Yes, there are risks. It's business, it's entrepreneurship, it's startup worlds. There will be some risk as well. But I think the rewards far supersedes the risks, because in South Africa, especially our tech space, really we have a lot of brilliant minds out there, black and white, coming up with brilliant solutions, brilliant innovations. If somebody can just pump money into them when they're still at pre-seed and seed, it's going to be a win-win situation, even for the high net worth individuals.
Yep. I think a question that's sort of obviously not on this sort of wavelength, right? But I think it's not asked often enough. It's just, what is your experience of, you know, entrepreneurship, business, startup world as a woman?
As a woman, it is very tough, because, you know, whatever boardroom you enter into, whatever events you go into, you're carrying a lot. You're carrying a lot on you. You're representing other women. You're carrying a million women in your shoulders. And you are seen as a woman before you are seen as a founder. They first see you as a woman before they see you as a founder. I've experienced that when I was in construction, when I was in mining, and even now when I'm in the tech world. So I think it's just a phenomenon that's going around globally, that people will see your femaleness first before they see the founder and the entrepreneur in you. So you're fighting a lot of battles, never mind being black. There's another battle on its own. So you always care, because, and if you go and present to people where they funded a black founder or a female founder who has failed, that person has failed for all of you. You'll be judged because of that person. But if it was just a white male person who has failed and another Mark or Rob comes along, they won't judge them because Peter has failed. So I think, as a woman, we carry that. But as a black woman, it becomes just, cumbersome, but you have to fight those. Yeah, that's the battle that we fight every day, unfortunately.
Right. Something that I think we haven't touched on yet was your own tech startup now, right? Can you just talk us through, like, what it is, what is it supposed to solve, and how far along the journey are you now?
Okay, yeah. My startup is called Nanny Now. You can find it at www.nannynow.co.za. I think that the problem that we are solving there is on-demand nanny hire for busy moms and busy dads. You have to go to the mall. We have a Lerato who needs to go to the mall or he needs to go to a funeral, and you just need a nanny for that few hours. So what we do is just you log on, you book a nanny, and we transport the nanny right to your premises. So we're offering convenience and on-demand nanny for parents out there. But that for me was a test. The thing was that I wanted to do this and go and scale it and take it that side. But I can't divulge more about it, but we'll be mainly working with, you know, your rent vacation rental companies and the like. So I was just validating it in South Africa, and I'll be going back that side in February to go and work on this.
So just finally, you've been through so many different iterations of your journey as an entrepreneur, as a businesswoman. What does success look like in 2020?
Well, in 2020, this year, success for me will be a product that's built overseas. It's now built here, but that's, you know, that has been polished and launched. I think for me, that will be my success. My success is my product market fit. My success would be my team market fit, because my team is very key. I already have a technical co-founder, and I have a team of people who've been working in this nanny industry for years, who are based in UK and the US. So for me, it will be that the team market fit, product market fit, and the launch. That will be my success.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, guys, for having me.
Pleasure.
It was a blast.
Oh, welcome, Ubu Bele, by the way.
Hi.
By the way. Give it one more chance.